This episode of The Stack was first broadcast on the 11th of May 2013 on Monocle 24.
The new Turkish edition of a world-renowned literary title, a fresh publication that celebrates the link between three great European cities, and an Istanbul-based correspondent with 20 years of experience covering this beat. Coming to you from the city formerly known as Constantinople, this is edition 37 of The Stack. Coming up over the next hour, we meet Berat Gocer, the new editor of the Turkish edition of Granta magazine.
I mean, we're very excited. It's just so great to be a part of this big family, I guess. I mean, sounds kind of cheesy maybe, but that's actually what it is.
Plus, we discover A Tale of Three Cities, a new publication that celebrates the relationship between Paris, Berlin, and London.
Some people have sort of suggested that we're a travel guide, and in a way we are, because we've got people writing about cities on sort of a much deeper level.
All that and a few reading tips from Andrew Finkel, contributing editor to Cornucopia, today on the special Turkish edition of The Stack. Hello from the rooftop of the George Hotel here in Istanbul and the special edition of The Stack here on Monocle 24. I'm Tyler Brûlé. Well, if all eyes have been on Turkey's infrastructure, transport and retail boom of late, we're going to cast our eye over the publishing scene in this country. While it's hard to miss the boisterous front covers of the country's dailies, it's even more difficult to escape the boom in Turkish soap operas and TV formats. Just as Brand Turkey is exporting the Crescent and Star to new runways and construction sites around the world, international media companies are also looking for deals to expand their brands in this market of just under 75 million people. We have a lot to get through over the next 55 minutes, so let's meet our guests who are joined by the horns, whoops, and squawks in the background of Istanbul. And joining us around our very lovely table with an even lovelier view across the Bosphorus here in Istanbul is Andrew Finkel. He's been a correspondent in Istanbul for almost two decades or 20 years. I don't know what sounds friendlier, whether it's we should break it into parts. Anyway, he's written for the Daily Telegraph, the New York Times, is a contributing editor to one of my favorite magazines. We were talking about it on our program last week, Cornucopia. I now receive it thanks to our Beirut correspondent. I received it as a gift, but I think I still always go and buy two copies at Daunt Books anyway, because I sometimes feel that they get it sooner. Andrew, welcome.
It's very nice to be here. Thank you very much.
Let's start maybe by setting up or setting out your stall as a correspondent who's been based here. One of the things, you know, as we've been in Istanbul for the last few days, I've been coming here for a little over a decade now. Many people say that, you know, you have correspondents here from the wire agencies, and of course they're all present, but it's actually not a big scene in this city for international journalists. It's not the hub of what Beirut once was, etc. Would you say that's still the case? Are things changing?
Well, things have changed certainly since the time I've been here. You've kindly mentioned that I've been here for two decades. People now call me a veteran journalist, and I sort of make a grim face when I hear that expression. But I suppose I am a veteran journalist. So I've seen in the chimes of midnight, I've seen a lot of changes since I've been here. And of course, in the old days, Istanbul really was, I came here before the end of the Cold War, and Istanbul was on the edge of something. It was a periphery. It wasn't, you know, the British papers had Stringer's eye strung for the Telegraph, and then after that, the Times. But many of the international press just didn't cover Turkey, or they covered it from Rome or from Athens or from Paris. And then people started plowing in. I think it was the New York Times had a permanent correspondent here, then the Wall Street Journal, and then the Washington Post. And suddenly people came plowing in, and the German papers started coming in. I mean, you'd think that, you know, given the fact that there's 2 million Turks living in Germany, you'd think that you could actually sell more newspapers if you had better coverage of Turkey in Germany. But that realization was very late in reaching the German press, and they eventually caught up. But then, of course, people would come here and they'd set up a bureau, and then they'd find they were in Pakistan the whole time, or in Afghanistan, or in Baghdad. So people began to sort of drift away from Istanbul a bit. Certainly the big bureaus, and the newspapers don't have bureaus anymore. It's a luxury they can't afford. So it's back to being a sort of freelance scene, I think, in Istanbul.
We've certainly seen a lot of international brands come here and do, let's say, franchise editions, the likes of, you know, there's, you know, Turkish Business Week. We saw the rise of CNN, you know, Turk as well. So in a way, are bigger organizations also maybe trying to piggyback off of their internet, well, let's say the editions that they franchised here, and taking content out of the market that way, do you think?
Well, that's certainly the case with CNN. I mean, I broadcast or have broadcast quite a bit with CNN, and they established this partnership with a Turkish media group, the big conglomerate, this Doğan Media Group, and that became the sort of the seed of a more permanent bureau here. So CNN certainly has come in, but it's, I mean, newspapers have tried and magazines have tried to sort of have a Turkish brand or a Turkish edition of Vogue or Cosmopolitan or, you know, Marie Claire, and some of them have been successful and some of them haven't. I think the magazine market is still quite small in Turkey. I mean, I've witnessed that too. I mean, even before I came as a journalist, I was here as an academic, and I suppose there's one name I should mention, which your listeners will never have heard of, but he was called Ercan Arıklı. His great contribution during the 1980s was to create a magazine scene in Turkey. And this was after the military coup, and sort of news was, you know, it was difficult to do news because it was political. So he suddenly realized what people wanted was lifestyle, and they wanted to know about, you know, what went on in the bedroom and in the kitchen and all these, you know, places where the Turkish press had never been. And so you suddenly had this whole new style of magazine and newspapers in the 1980s. And it was very much in reaction to a period of military rule. It's quite funny that that should have been the case, but that is the case.
I mean, it's interesting how you talk about the magazine scene, because when you drive around Istanbul, you see these rather abundant kiosks. My next guest is someone who's hoping to fill them, probably not everyone on every street corner, but Berat Gocer is the editor of the new, freshly, right off the press, Turkish edition of Granta magazine. Of course, many of our listeners will be familiar with the mother edition, of course, which comes out of the UK. But there are now 10 editions internationally of the title. And Berat, I wanted to start with the idea. How much of a sell was it to, you know, go to London and tell the Granta team that you wanted to do an edition in Turkey?
Actually, it's interesting. It was Granta UK that came to Turkey wanting to print a Turkish edition.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think with Granta Turkey, this is the 12th international edition that Granta had, because now Finland, it's going to be coming out in Finland and Japan and China as well. And they were always very interested in this big international collaboration in various parts of the world. So Turkey was one of those countries that they were really eager to see their magazine published in. And they came here with, Ella Alfrey came here with ITEF, International Tamponar Literary Festival, and also with British Council. And she met with a few publishers, and she thankfully, fortunately, decided to go ahead with Everest Publications. I mean, we're very excited. It's just so great to be a part of this big family, I guess. I mean, sounds kind of cheesy maybe, but that's actually what it is. So we had our very first issue came out about 2 weeks ago in time for the London Book Fair. It's a theme magazine, so the first theme was identity. I mean, I guess Andrew would know that's a very big issue in Turkey, and it sounds kind of a cliche, but I think we found it very important to study and discuss and to sort of come out with it, because we have just so many different cultures living here.
Well, tell me about the challenges of going in and commissioning the first issue and bringing in those writers, and also dealing with, you know, a topic, of course, where you could build a library around it in this country.
Exactly. So the format is half of the issue comes from the English archives and half of it is Turkish original writing. So we had, I guess, two challenges. We had to pick and select from a very vast archive, and then we also had to select the Turkish authors who will be writing about identity. And we really wanted to capture the cosmopolitanism of this city and this country. So we were very keen on selecting someone that comes from a different background that could write that could bring something new to this topic that's been talked about and that's been written about so many times. So we have an amazing short story by Aisha Duskan, who's really known for her feminist stand. We have a great story by Yekta Kopan and Ahmet Tugar and Karin Karakash, these wonderful people. And in terms of the English authors, we were really keen on capturing stuff that maybe wasn't really seen here. So we have great stories from Sri Lanka, from different parts of the world, including UK, of course.
Andrew, I wanted to ask you, just going back to, you talk about sort of, you know, the celebration of sort of identity, and I want to talk about Cornucopia for a second, because as I said, we touched on it last week. This is a very peculiar magazine because it's so wonderful, and in many ways, as everything print does, it's a very dear friend, and I'm very complimented in the sense that it doesn't sort of move on. You can always sort of pick up where you left off. For people who aren't familiar with Cornucopia, maybe I'll give you, hopefully the not too difficult task of defining it. And where does it sit on the bedside table? And what position does it take, would you say?
Well, it's a difficult question. Cornucopia is, it is a wonderful thing. It's sort of, you know, it's a magnifique, mais c'est pas la guerre. It's sort of one person's hobby horse, I suppose, or a couple's hobby horse, John and Baron Scott, who were the editors and the owners of the magazine. So it's very much their child. And at the same time, it's certainly not amateurish. It's an incredibly professionally produced, very glossy, incredible photography. And we often joke that if only Turkey were like it was in Cornucopia, there would be no problems here at all. I have to say, I've been writing it from the very first issue. I worked with John on a previous magazine called Turquoise, which was not quite so wonderful. And John, sort of all the mistakes and all the sort of frustrations he had with that magazine, he was determined to resolve in his new magazine. And really, from the very first edition, of which I have a copy, which apparently is now worth, you know, Fort Knox, if I ever wanted to sell it. From the very first edition, it just looked better than anything else anyone had ever seen in Turkey. The photographs were, you know, more incisive, more evocative, more atmospheric than anything else. And the writing, and he also pays attention to the writing, which I have to say, because I'm one of the writers, you know.
And is this a title which is known within the borders of Turkey, or cause sometimes I feel it is one of these delightful pieces of print that probably has a very different life and also maybe a more renowned status outside of this country?
Well, I think it reflects the personality of its owner. It's a little bit diffident. I think, you know, had it belonged to somebody else, they would have gone out and they would have marketed the name Cornucopia as the sort of symbol of everything that's worth seeing, eating, doing, tasting in Turkey. I'm also, it's a restaurant critic, I have to confess. I think he's, you know, for example, John will, I mean, this, he'll, someone will give him an ad and he'll say, no, this isn't really up to our standards. We're not going to use this ad, you know, and people, especially in a Turkish context, will look at him as if he's, you know, mad. I mean, he's, you know, upset major hotel chains because he says their ads are vulgar, and indeed they are, and he won't print them in his magazine. It's wonderful in a way. So it means that there's a certain sort of limit to his reach. I mean, I think it sells about 20,000, and maybe half of that is subscription, perhaps a little bit less than half of that is subscription. It gets distributed in all the luxury hotels which don't have vulgar ads.
But yeah, I was going to say, I mean, other countries should be so lucky to have, well, a title which is not, you know, underwritten by a tourism agency or some, you know, some other agent within the government that is such a, you know, a brilliant celebration, culinary, literary, you know, culturally, as Cornucopia is.
It is that. It is a celebration of really what's best in Turkey, but it's done by someone who really understands what's best in Turkey, as opposed to some committee or a tourism agency, as you say. So it's deeply personal in a way, and you know, he'll miss copy dates to get it right. I mean, it's a very eccentric project, but it's wonderful, as you say.
You're listening to a very special edition of The Stack. We're coming to you from Istanbul. You can, of course, hear the sounds of a city in development. I think there's a bit of a saw going on. If I look around the corner, I can see that I think someone is definitely trying to build a new roof terrace where we're broadcasting from the top of the Georges Hotel. We are going to take a very short break. We're back in a moment.
In a region typified by change, Istanbul is in the middle of a renaissance of its own. Monocle Films visits the historic city to witness its contemporary metamorphosis.
Battles over the projected identity of Turkey on the landmarks of the city translate into protest. While disagreement over the future exists, pride in the changes is not in short supply.
Istanbul Inspired, a film about change in an ever-changing city on Monocle.com.
And you're listening to the special edition of The Stack here on Monocle 24. Today we are coming to you from Istanbul, and my guests around the table here at the Georges Hotel are Andrew Finkel and Berek Gutcher. Berek, just tell me, we touched upon the kiosk a little bit earlier. How do you see the print scene, but I guess the periodical scene as opposed to books? Because I have this very romantic notion of the newsstand here, and I can recall, I think the first time I ever came to Istanbul, I went to Nishantashi, and there was this newsstand was just bursting with all kinds of international titles and also domestic titles, and I saw this played out in a couple of other places around the city as well. And so in my mind, when I go back to London, I think of people in their apartments, in their villas, in the city, just surrounded by loads of print. And there's so many newspapers with crazy front pages here. I mean, there's something so peculiar about the art direction of Turkish newspapers, so lively and loud. So I have this idea that people are surrounded by print. But yet when I speak to people, they say, in fact, this is not really a society that's that into paper. So if we ventured out, it's a Saturday. What is the kiosk, magazine store, bookstore scene like in Istanbul?
I think that you're very right about the international magazines, because when you go to a kiosk and you're looking at all these magazines, I think there are two types. One is all these Turkish editions of the international magazines, you have the you have fashion magazines, you have the business magazines and everything. And then you have all these Turkish magazines that are sort of always, I think, clustered in one corner. Especially with the fashion magazines, the interior design magazines and all that stuff, I think it's very hard to find just this Turkish edition that was, that's purely Turkish, that's a Turkish title that's been printed here, that's been made by people that are only here and that has a title that's, Turkish. But when it comes to more literary stuff and maybe more into cultural things like music and movies, I think it's we have a very rich array of options, especially with sort of magazines that print short stories and poems. I think it's just an incredible array of options. But the thing is, distribution is incredibly difficult. So with those stuff, you can't really find them everywhere. You can't find them in like one of those little tobacco shop kiosks, but you can only find them in big bookshops that are like chains maybe. And sometimes not even those, sometimes just like sort of the independent bookshop that's on the corner and everyone goes there just to get those magazines. So, I actually have a few of them here. And they come out and they're sometimes around for a few years and then they have to close their shop. But then the teams are just so incredibly enthusiastic about what they do, and a new one comes out. So it's very actually hard to keep track of what's going on. It's very live, it's very energetic. I'm not sure if that's necessarily what they would hope for, because they would obviously want their magazines to go on for a long time, but still they never ever give up. So on a Saturday, if you really want to read something very Turkish and that's very captures what's going on in the city, like I said, in terms of cultural news, you have, I think, a great option. But I just don't know if, like you said, if people are interested. Aside from people who deal with books and paper and on a professional basis, I think it's very hard for them to reach their audiences.
And Andrew, of course, you'd be familiar with international markets. Of course, the challenges that are happening with bookstores and, as Berek said, just distribution might be hard here. But even, as we've seen the decline of bookstores both independent and chains elsewhere. You know, it's become very difficult, you know, certainly for many a magazine publisher. Where do you think Turkey is in the cycle right now? Because on one side, you've got this, you know, incredible boom of malls. There's a retail explosion going on here. So is it sort of the first, you know, blush? Maybe there's still room for the big media chains that can sell, you know, books and magazines? Or is this a city which is also just full of, you know, rich little interesting, you know, bookshops, and that's the future? How do you see it?
Well, I think that the trend certainly is in chains, and these are the people who, I mean, Istanbul certainly is becoming one big shopping mall, and many Turkish cities the same. And many of us sort of lament the way that the city is developing, and, you know, part of the accoutrements of a shopping mall is that you have a bookstore, and usually it's one of the big chains, and they of course control the distribution and are quite sort of tough customers. I think you really have to look at the advertising market to understand where publishing is going, and it's a very, very difficult market. I mean, I think people have sort of assumed that print is dead, even though it's not, and they're certainly discounting the advertising rates and trying to bury publications. So I think it's a very hard market to survive in. I mean, I'm giving the wrong message here, because I know this is a program in celebration of the printed word. But I'm afraid the internet is really where the future lies, and where people will drift. And you know, if I'm allowed to sort of exercise a bit of nepotism here, I mean, I have a daughter who's just started a literary magazine on things Turkish, and of course the way you start up is on the net. It's, you know, bulentjournal.com, for those who are listening, and it's, you know, it's quite esoteric. It's like the con, you know, it's, perhaps it could fit in the grand hub, but it's you know, where do you start? You have to start on the net these days, and then hopefully move to print if that's possible.
What does, I'll throw this out to both of you, but just before we go and listen to a little story about a magazine covering other major cities a little bit to the west of here, is there a typical media diet, would you say, where you know, if we're in New York, you know, of course you would say that someone reads the Times, and that person might also, you know, buy both, you know, New York and the New Yorker, and they're taking these three other titles monthly. Menander, I'll start with you. I mean, is there a must-read weekly to understand Turkish society, business, politics, which would fit into a bit of a economist Time type of space in terms of a general interest Newsweekly? What sort of driving gossip here? What does it look like?
I didn't think there is, to be perfectly honest.
There's an opportunity.
Really,
well, I mean, there were magazines which tried to do that role. There was one thing called Actuel, and there was something called Tempo, and they died the death. I mean, they never really got the circulation to justify their existence. And I mean, the newspapers that people have to read, I mean, they do it with great suspicion, because the media world is deeply, deeply compromised by the non-media interests of its proprietors. So everyone reads Hürriyet, but they read Hürriyet with a, you know, in inverted commas, because they try and read what the sort of message is, how the editors are sort of getting under the wire or over the wire, what exactly, you know, what pressures they're trying to resist or accommodate. So, you know, there's certain big circulating newspapers which people have to read every day, I suppose, or if you want to stay informed. I mean, my friends would read Hürriyet because they have to, and then they would look at the arts coverage in Radikal, and then probably before it sort of imploded, there was a newspaper which I had a column on, a Turkish paper called Taraf, which sadly is you know in the process of committing slitting its wrists and dying a slow death, but that you would read for sort of a semi-independent take on what the news was.
The interesting point is how you have to sort of read the art section of one specific newspaper, but then maybe the foreign news section of another newspaper
stop me if I'm wrong, Brad, because you know understand it's much better than I possibly could, but I mean, you don't get book reviews in this country. You don't get sort of cinema reviews. I mean, you'll get sort of, they'll say, yes, this film is playing at this cinema and go and see it because the star is in it. But they won't say, see this and don't see that, or read this and don't read that.
No, there are absolutely no reviews of any kind. I can tell you that. I mean, there are sort of what we call tanıtım, which is, I guess, like an introduction to the piece. So you have all these book journals that every single major newspaper prints out a book review supplement, but it's never a review. It's always about this book talks about that, and this author also had that book, but you never really get a critique of anything. It's actually one of our biggest complaints in the book publishing industry, I can tell you that. But yeah, you never really get that. I mean, maybe magazines, sort of like Altyazı, the movie magazines, yeah, and other, sort of go into more depth, but then you only have so many pages. If you only have one magazine doing it, then where are you going to really...
So you should have started
it?
The Istanbul Review of Books, not Grant.
I think there is an Istanbul Review of Books in English, too.
I'll be a dog. I didn't know that.
Yeah. We're going to just jump to some other capitals right now, though. Paris, Berlin, and London have a special relationship throughout history. These European creative hubs have shared ideas, literature, and art. Alex Tighe Walker has distilled this link into a new magazine called The Tale of Three Cities, published by London's Ditto Press. This handsome, small-form magazine celebrates emerging young writers, artists, and photographers from what Tighe Walker calls the Golden Triangle. Tighe Walker dropped into Midori House recently, where he spoke with the Stax researcher, David Pleasant.
Rosa and I were at university, my co-editor-in-chief, and when we left, we sort of went our separate ways, and she moved to Paris and I moved to London. And we thought it'd be quite good to sort of work on a collaborative project, and what better way than to sort of unite creatives from the two cities. And then we realised actually we needed to put a third into the mix, just to sort of shake it up a little bit more, I suppose.
Is it not complicated enough, kind of trying to cover two cities? Why did you... Very ambitious to cover three... Very different cities. Which cities did you choose?
Well, we chose London, Paris and Berlin. We sort of wanted to keep it in Europe. There's a very transient group. There are a lot of people moving around between the three cities for work. We've sort of got lots of friends who've gone off to sort of do stints in Berlin. They've gone to do stints in Paris. There's a sort of a nice unity. They're all very cultural cities, but in very different ways. I think sort of Berlin's a lot more relaxed than London and Paris, who sort of have these older institutes. Sort of creativity is a lot more formalised in London and Paris. And that's why adding Berlin was interesting as well, because it's just a totally different vibe. I don't know. The creative scene's a little bit, dare I say, hippie. It's just a lot more easygoing.
What did you want to kind of cover in terms of those three cities? What unites it in terms of the content of the journal? What is there one thread?
We bring a theme to each issue, and the theme of this issue is home. So we've asked our contributors to sort of sum up how they associate belonging somewhere. You know, we spoke to Alain de Botton. He often talks about his relationship with London, so we thought what better person to have than him sort of explaining what makes him feel at home, where he wants to grow old, what he wants to do with the place where he lives. And we asked all our contributors to sort of summarise what they thought about home and what that means to them.
And let's talk about the design of the journal. It's a wonderful object to hold. It's a lovely size. What was your approach to that?
We were actually sort of aiming to go somewhere between a magazine and a book. We definitely didn't have enough experience to put a book together. Actually, we sort of barely had enough experience to put a magazine together. But we wanted something that was very solid. In our first issue, we published our sort of manifesto, which was called Solidism, and it was basically celebrating the tangible. We wanted to give it as many textures as possible. You know, the dust jacket, it's not just paper wrapped around the journal. It's got ridges and textures, and we chose very nice textured paper, and we've got different papers. The photography section's on a much more sort of glossy surface, and that's also why we printed it using Ditto Press, who are risograph printers. So again, the ink sort of sits on top of the page. It's not part of the page, and that adds another dimension.
And in terms of how you get the magazine, the journal together, is it a collaborative process between the three cities? Do you have input from Berlin and Paris and London, or is it kind of steered from here in London?
It's an English language publication, so there's always it's going to feel in a way more at home in London. The contributors, we do have international contributors. Nafkoti, for example, well, she's actually American but living in Paris. But I sort of looking at the idea of home, it's not really rooted in one place, because home can be wherever you feel at home in a way. I certainly have felt at home in more than one city, and I think that comes out through the journal.
There's this lovely element. You've actually put a pressed flower in a little transparent envelope, and that kind of falls out. And in the background of that particular page, there's a flower resting on a washing machine. It's a very kind of domestic, lovely kind of scene. So you're really kind of trying to engage the reader in the visuals of the theme of the journal as well.
I mean, that story is my favourite in the journal. It's by these guys, Eleanor and Simon, who are based in Paris. And they run a blog called Le Fleuriste, where they invite florists to donate flowers, which they then photograph and accompany it with a piece of literature. So we asked them to choose a flower, one for each city, which they felt represented that city. by actually putting a pressed flower in sort of brings that story in a way more to life. And listening to sort of the way people talk about what they've done with that flower, because some people have taken it out and sort of stuck it on windows, and some people just leave it in the journal because that's sort of where they see it as living. But it adds another dimension.
And did you as editor press those flowers yourself?
they were quick pressed with an iron. it was quite a last minute decision to put the wildflowers in.
Well, it looks very professional, I have to say.
You look like
an expert flower presser has been involved in the editorial process. And if you just think about the reader, what do you think? I mean, it's quite a kind of tactile experience flicking through the journal. What are you hoping that the reader feels when they open the book?
I hope that they think about the issues that we're bringing up. I hope that they start questioning sort of what their idea of home is. It's about engaging them with... Some people have sort of suggested that we're a travel guide, and in a way we are, because we've got people writing about cities.
And that was Alex Tighe-Walker of The Tale of Three Cities talking to our David Pleasant. You're listening to a special edition of The Stack. We are in Istanbul. We're back in a moment. And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24, a very special edition of the program. We're coming to you from Istanbul today. You can hear the squawking of seagulls, the toot of the odd horn on a ferry across the Bosphorus, and also a lot of construction, because there is certainly, and there it is on cue, this gentleman building a roof terrace across the way. My guests today are Berat Gocer, the editor of Granta magazine, the new Turkish edition, fresh off the press about 2 weeks ago, and correspondent Andrew Finkel, been based in this market for some 20 years now. He's also the author of Turkey, What Everyone Needs to Know, also a frequent contributor to Cornucopia magazine, which we were talking about a little bit earlier. I want to actually reference really the pace of development that's happening here. And as you were saying, a lot of people, Andrew, are lamenting the boom of the mall. I was talking to some developers earlier in the week. It's incredible, you know, how many new projects are coming up. And just while we're here, I mean, there's always this wonderful vitality on the street, and we talk about the kiosk and just, you know, the sense of just great neighborhoods in this city. I don't want to sort of divert too far away from the printed page, but is there an active dialogue here right now about this concern in terms of what is happening with development? And is it really, you know, Berat, would you say, is it, you know, the developer pitted against the preservationists? Or is there also a consciousness, you know, on the part of just regular residents that that maybe the shift is happening too quickly, or maybe with too heavy a hand?
I think it's a one-way dialogue with people complaining about it and then no one's really replying. I think it is going too fast, and the main issue is not necessarily that there are this many developments going on, but that they're not really talked about beforehand. No one's really explaining to anyone, really, not in the neighborhood and not in the city in general, about what they're doing and why they're doing it and what they're planning while they're doing it and how it's going to change the neighborhood. So I think what's missing is the dialogue about why it's going on. And I think it's there. On the one hand, you have the developments doing, you know, the buildings and whatnot, and then on the other hand you have the government doing all sorts of different constructions in the Taksim Square and all other areas of the city. And I think it's a big concern about how not necessarily just environmentally what it's going to be doing to the city, but also in terms of how it's going to be changing the neighborhood and the dynamics of the city and of the historical center. So I think we do need to talk about it a bit more before it actually happens. It's sort of, right now, it's just people saying they're going to do it, and the next day you see a big construction has started up. So it's a big concern.
Mm. Andrew, just as you were saying, there's not a culture of the review of theater or cinema, etc., in the newspapers. Is there a culture then of the urbanism correspondent, the architecture critic? Does that exist? If I picked up the hoodie and went to page, you know, 14, would I find a critical article by someone who's informed, either ex-politics or an academic who can have a critical dialogue about the development of the city?
Well, you would have once upon a time. I think in the old days when there was a newspaper, it still exists, called Cumhuriyet, you know, page 2 of Cumhuriyet would have a very learned, insightly inedible article on you know, architectural changes. And you still see that. But Turkish newspapers very much rely on the sort of the polemic of the front page. But of course, it has to be said that all the major press groups in this country also have very huge construction interests. So you're not going to see very critical discussion of whether Turkey really needs the world's largest airport with six runways when people in London are protesting against Heathrow building a third runway, or a sort of canal project which will, you know, which is totally pointless as far as anyone could see, which will cost billions and billions and billions of dollars, or whether Turkey really should be hosting the 2020 Olympics. These aren't discussions that even, you know, flicker into the public realm. So I mean, many of us who, you know, because I have this sort of bizarre career of having worked both in the Turkish language and the international press, with my Turkish hat, and when I sit down with my colleagues, you know, we weep about the state of the Turkish press and the inability to address really this very major issue of a city which is like a sort of cannibal consuming itself. You know, it's been here too long. I came here for the first time in the 60s when it was a city of 1.5 million people. Now it's a city of 14 million people. Every 10 or 15 years of my life, this city has doubled in population. And it does occur to me that there will be a sort of limit beyond which it cannot expand, or it cannot expand as a sustainable city. And I don't think the warning bells are there. You know, people should be seeing this and they're not.
Berk, do you think, and maybe your generation, as you know, so many young Turks, you know, are going abroad to study, and certainly, I mean, you already see, you know, from the, I guess, upper middle classes, you know, better families, you know, people returning with new ideas, you know, also maybe just being immersed and experiencing different media environments. Does that encourage you? I mean, here, granted, it gets underway in this country, but do you think it also, you know, creates space for a new type of news brand, not tethered to one of the big families? Maybe, you know, is this a possibility where you would certainly see a new climate created to maybe address some of the things that Andrew's talking about?
Well, I mean, I was myself one of those people who studied abroad. I went to NYU for my undergrad degree, and I came back here and I started working in a publishing house when everyone was talking about the print being dead and the new thing being the internet. So I guess I am very hopeful about new ideas being discussed in print, be it magazines or in books or in newspapers. I am very hopeful. I don't know why. I mean, I don't think there's anything to support that idea, but I do feel like, I mean, there's a very large group of people who feel like their voices aren't really being heard, or that they don't actually have an outlet where they can discuss things, not necessarily just, you know, on a good table with each other, but with others. So I do think there are very exciting new titles coming out, and even if they're not enough, even if they do get shut down, I think people are just so enthusiastic and so eager to find something that they can call their own, that is not controlled by, you know, the big conglomerates, that we will see interesting developments in print.
Well, you've both brought a variety of interesting titles with you. We're going to take a very, very short pause for a commercial break, though. You're listening to The Stack here in Istanbul. When we come back, we are going to delve into some of the local treasures in print. Stay with us.
Switzerland is the natural home of timekeeping and host to Baselworld, the most important international platform for the business of watchmaking. Monocle dispatched a film crew to investigate this year's innovation.
Baselworld attracts everybody from every tiny niche of the watch industry as a whole, and that can be somebody who buys components, somebody who sells completed watches, somebody who sells watch cases, somebody who writes about watches, and you can't really miss it.
Horological showmanship at the Basel Fairground. Check out our film on monocle.com.
And you are back with The Stack here on Monocle 24. Special edition of today's program. We are coming to you from Istanbul. And, of course, you will certainly hear a little bit of construction and a rather windy day. I thought it was going to be sunny, and maybe it would be sort of probably sweltering under certainly under a hot sky at this table in our rooftop position. I'm, of course, joined today by Berit Gocher, who's the editor of Granta magazine, and also correspondent journalist Andrew Finkel, and perhaps of note, author of Turkey, What Everyone Needs to Know. Why don't we start, Andrew, on what or with what people need to know when it comes to print? I've, of course, we've given you the assignment of course, presenting titles maybe familiar or unfamiliar to our listenership. We talked about Cornucopia in great detail. We've touched on the daily papers. What do you want to start with on the periodical side?
I bought a deliberately eclectic collection of publications, and I suppose I lived here as a schoolboy, and of course. One of the ways I learned Turkish was by reading these humor magazines. And Turkey has a great tradition of humor magazines. I've bought two of them. Funnily enough, they don't seem so funny now that I'm a little bit older. But there you go. These are great. You know, having been reared on Mad magazine as a child in the States, I there was a magazine called Gürgür, which is, you know, basically what every sort of, you know, adolescent reads. And, you know, it's a little bit smutty, a little bit left-wing, a little bit this, a little bit that. And surprisingly, sort of what critical tradition there is in Turkish youth, I think, is transmitted through these satirical magazines.
Well, you have two here, so I've got a copy of Gürgür here, which is the first of the eighth of May edition, and I've also got this one is called Leman. And do they sit also? I mean, these are comics. I don't read Turkish. This is pitched at late teens and up. When would you first pick these up?
I think probably earlier, wouldn't you? You'd sort of 13, 14.
Is exactly, that? Especially with Gürgür and Leman. But I just have to note that there are also Uykusuz and Penguin that are, comic magazines like these, but they're very political and they're very satirical. And as everyone reads them, you don't really have an age for that. And especially in terms of what's going on with the politically, those are the magazines where you can both follow what's going on, like what the latest minister said, but also where you can sort of hope to criticize them. So it's very interesting.
I mean, the curious thing is that there was a magazine called Akbaba, which means vulture, which was one of the biggest selling. I mean, I think Crocodile was the Soviet Crocodile was a bigger selling humor magazine, but it was the second largest humor magazine in the world once upon a time. It no longer exists, of course. But this was, you know, throughout the sort of heavy hand of the early days of the Republic, this was the sort of the only way that people could really talk out and protest. And there's an online magazine called Zeitung, which is a sort of Turkish, it's sort of Zeitung in German, written in a Turkish way, which, you know, it's the Mother Jones. It's the Private Eye cover of Turkey. It's
kind of like the Onion in Turkish.
The Onion, and it's
right,
you know,
right.
The slightly satirical, and it's actually very. Some of the items it does are very, very clever.
And would these titles, would these belong to major groups, or are these more? I mean, obviously they've been around for a while. They've got a position in the market, but are they almost media brands in their own right?
They are. They started out as independents. I think some of them have been bought up. I don't actually know the answer to that question.
I think they're still, most of them are very independent.
Yeah.
But, and obviously, I can see probably, you know, there's not a lot of advertising, so just they're surviving, obviously, on massive Cirque to survive.
That's right. And they're printed on what everyone in Turkish knows the expression, a third dough newspaper, which is, you know, the cheapest newsprint there is, you know, the kind that, you know, wasps make their nests out of.
What do you want to start with in terms of the titles you've brought?
Bir Artı Bir and Express, and the same, they're printed by the same team, published by the same team. And they also had another magazine called Roll, which is sadly out of print. And these are also very independent. And Bir Artı Bir is more cultural, I guess. They're unfortunately old issues. And Express is much more political. And they print a lot of interviews, both with Turkish people and foreign artists. And they have a lot of really very in-depth and critical articles on each theme and issue that they're covering. I mean, I think they're just great.
Yeah, I mean, this is incredible because, and I say this in a very polite way, but Bir Bir, this is from 2011, but if I look at it, actually, if I took the date off it and you said this was from 1988, I would also believe you as well. And it has this wonderful hand to it. It's all black and white, and on this, yeah, just this very tactile matte paper stock, which is, and where did this I would say exist. I mean, this is something that people would have been picking up at a kiosk, and or would this have been more specialized to university bookstores? Where would you have found that magazine?
You used to be able to, I guess, find them everywhere, but I remember Bir Artı Bir was sort of censored, in quotation marks, by one of the biggest bookselling chains, because I can't quite remember the specific issue that did that, but I mean, something they wrote that did not fit well with the big conglomerate that owned the bookshop, so they decided just not to sell it. So, so it is very political in that sense. And I feel like it's the reason why it's just so simple in terms of the paper and the format is just because it's all about what's written inside.
And yeah, that's and well, the like same the it. Same feeling from Express as well. Mm-hmm. And again, either you have a very sunny flat, because it just, you look at sort of the edges of the pages, and it's got this sort of wonderful sort of yellowness to it. And again, 2009 date stamp on the front cover, but we could be looking at something which is, you know, really from 25 years ago or so.
Yeah, these are really magazines that you want to keep in your library.
Yeah.
That's why they're so old.
Yeah.
The issues are so old.
Andrew, I can see you've got a copy of Metro Gastro in front of you. So as you've mentioned, obviously you're in charge of the culinary restaurant review beat for Fornucopia. So I guess this has a special place in your heart.
Well, that's right. If this were television, people would be able to see that I enjoy my dinners. Metro Gastro, it sounds like a medical journal, doesn't it?
It does.
But in fact, it's not. It's a food magazine, and it's published by a company called Metro, which also has a chain of sort of cash and carry stores. For all that, it's actually a very well-produced magazine, and it's a very intelligently edited magazine. It takes a slightly sort of anthropological view of food. It takes itself incredibly seriously. It goes off to sort of provincial places around Turkey, and it investigates the authenticity of dishes, and very much influenced by the slow food movement, of which, you know, I used to be a jury member. You know, the idea of producing decent, you know, that you basically save the world with a knife and fork, that you save the world by eating it, and you save the environment by consuming it, that if you create a market for sustainable, decent food, then that actually provides a livelihood and an incentive for people to produce good food. So it's got its heart in very much in the right place. It's certainly earnest.
Have you seen the same type of culinary publishing boom, certainly with magazines? So, you know, whether we've had the likes of Jamie in the UK and so many other spin-offs, in many cases, not like this, where you've also had, you know, very good grocery stores in many markets putting out really fantastic food magazines. Would you say this is sort of leading that, and then have many others sort of jumped on the same bandwagon?
Well, I think Turkey's still a country where, you know, everyone's favorite celebrity chef is their own mother. Food is still sort of craft, not art. But I think there's certainly a move to change all that. The great sort of food writers appear in the newspaper, and they sort of very much look like your, you know, your Aunt Rose or whatever. They're certainly of a certain age and of a certain weight, and they, you know, they look like they enjoy their food. It's not the sort of lean, mean, sort of aggressive chefs that you get in elsewhere in the world.
On the other side of things, Barak, there are several magazines that come up again and again on this program, and people bring along Kinfolk magazine and many others of the same sort of ilk, fire, knives. All of these self-published, very sort of niche, but, you know, you talked about sort of your titles in sort of the literary realm as well, and you've had this sort of boom in other markets, a lot of things coming off the, you know, the U.S. West Coast. Has that happened here? Are you seeing people doing little vanity self-published projects? You know, again, maybe just celebrating granny's dishes from the eastern extremes of Anatolia?
Well, in terms of sort of like more visual self-published magazines, I can't really think of any. But in terms
of, we'll take that as a no. It's not happening.
But in terms of a blog being becoming print, actually, one of the magazines that I brought, and apparently Andrew brought it also, Sabit Fikir, used to be a literary blog, well, mostly a news blog about literature. It's actually owned by Edifix, one of the largest online booksellers, which is now.
And Edifix only exists as an Amazon in a way?
I think that Edifix means, of course, Edifix, and Sabir Fikir is Turkish for Edifix. So, that's the origins of all that.
Edifix, it was like is like Amazon, and it's now owned by the Dawn Group, so it's a part of a big conglomerate. And Sabit Fikir was, I think it was printed maybe a few months or maybe a year after the blog started up. Mm-hmm. And they're all about wanting to publish real critiques of books. So, and I think they do succeed in doing that more so than the other literary journals. And they also have just news in general, and they're more of a younger that the publishers are younger, and the editor-in-chief Elif Bereketli certainly is, and they're all about the visual. I think they're one of the few magazines that actually have people illustrate the pieces specifically, not just, you know, get it on iStock. But
and why did you choose to bring it in as well? What was it?
Well, I think that I have to show that there's hope that people do read books and want to know about books. You know, it was a vote for the future.
That's very good. We probably have time for maybe just two more titles. You have, is that Paros in front of you?
I bought two copies of Paros. Okay. So that Paros is it's 1 year old, or just over 1 year old. And what it is, it's a strange magazine in a way. It's a magazine put out by an Armenian editor, and it's sort of a celebration, I guess, of being a minority in Turkey, of not being a part of the Muslim mainstream, but being sort of Armenian or Greek or Jewish or whatever. So in a sense, it's like sort of Ebony was in the right. early 60s, if you like. It's sort of...
It's celebrating minorities in general. It doesn't just veer to being solely focusing on Armenians.
No, not solely on... But in the Turkish context, what it means to be an Armenian,
sure,
means to be a non-Muslim citizen of Turkey. And the articles are about non-Muslim citizens of Turkey, historically and today. And so it's...
And how much of a discussion has this created, you know, within the country? I mean, again, is this something that gets picked up by the newspapers, that someone, you know, covers it, you know, as a media business story, is it covered as a cultural story?
Well, not the magazine itself, I have to say, but I think you know, the role of minorities and the past of minorities and the future of minorities in this country is much more actively discussed than it ever was, and certainly the Armenian case has been put forward, and very much as the tragic consequence of the assassination of the editor of the Armenian newspaper 5 or 6 years ago, Hrant Dink, a friend of all of ours, who was, you know, through some bizarre plot and conspiracy, was actually shot in front of his newspaper. Mm. And of course, that, I think, drove home to many people the need to face facts.
I want to just maybe end on a note with an eye to the future. I mean, Berek, I guess just we didn't really touch on sort of early responses to Granta and your addition in this country. How have people responded? I guess the party is yet to happen, though, so we're a little bit ahead of it.
Well, it came out, like I said, a few weeks ago, but we're very excited about how much it's been covered already. I mean, it was covered in the press even before it got out, but in general, in social media, we're very excited about people's reactions to it. Just so many people have already sent their short stories that they want to be published, and people were very excited that, I mean, both people who knew the UK edition of Granta are very excited that we now have Granta Turkey, but also people who didn't are very just excited that they have a new literary magazine.
And finally, I don't want to say elder statesman, but we'll come back to...
I can take a hint.
So. Yeah, but time spent in the market, and you talk about, you know, really both the upheavals, but, you know, many of the positive things that are happening in this market. Your prognosis of the kiosk and bookstore, an exciting time. Should, if anyone's listening anywhere in the world, should they upstate in Sydney and maybe you know, have a go at launching an interesting you know, bookstore, come gallery, come kiosk on the streets below us here?
You know, this is a country of 75 million people. Half of them are under the age of 29. It has to be a place where people will come and want to come and shout.
I hope you probably didn't hear it here first, but certainly encouraging news for anyone who maybe wants to carve an interesting path in the world of print. I want to thank my guest, Andrew Finkel, journalist. But we didn't get to talk about your book too much. Just tell us very, very quickly about Turkey, what everyone needs to know.
The book has two main markets. One is for, you know, the educated non-specialist who needs to sort of learn a lot about Turkey in a quick way, in an entertaining way. And the other marketers, my friends, and I
otherwise, what's the point of going into publishing,
and,
right?
And I've written a series of essays. It takes the form of questions and answers. I ask myself a question, I give the answer, and I try to do it in a essay which my friends who actually know about Turkey will enjoy reading, as well as those who don't.
Excellent. Well, that brings us to the end of this special Istanbul edition of The Stack. My guests today have been Andrew Finkel and Berek Gotcher, of course, the editor of the freshly minted Turkish edition of Granta. Our producers here in Istanbul, Phil Hahn, and our researchers are Adrian Craddock and Alexander Kramer. And just behind me is Sam Impey, who's been working the audio for the show. If you have any comments or thoughts for our program, then do drop us a note to info@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday. I won't be here. I do believe my chair will be taken either by our editor, Andrew Tuck, or, of course, our news editor, Tom Edwards. And, of course, you can always listen again via monocle.com or iTunes. But for now, from all of us here in Istanbul, I'm Tyler Brulé. Have a good weekend.